Anyone using the ChatGPT or Copilot or AI tools?
Yeah, some stuff. Yeah, I'm very cautious.
Have you seen the video with the robot? I don't know. There was a video of a robot a few days ago. A guy having a conversation with it, asking it to put a plate on a shelf and to hand him something to eat, and it was an apple. And
Wow. Can I have something to eat?
Sure thing.
Great. Can you explain why you did what you just did while you pick up this trash?
On it. So I gave you the apple because it's the only edible item I could provide you with from the table.
Great. So, based on the scene right now, where do you think the dishes in front of you go next?
The dishes on the table, like that plate and cup, are likely to go into the drying rack next.
Sort of tech demo, but I think the robot was using some version of ChatGPT, so that was interesting.
Right. Didn't see that. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. When you start combining technologies, that's when things get interesting. Things on their own, not so much. But yeah, I remember a talk a guy called Mark Stevenson gave a long time ago. He's a futurologist. He's one of the only people I've actually seen who I think deserves that title as well. And he talks about the future in quite a funny way, accessible. And he says, "Well, did you know that you can now 3D print chemicals, right?" So this was about 10 years ago as well. I saw this talk. He's like, "Yep, at the molecular level, we can now 3D print a chemical. And what do chemicals make? They make drugs. Right. Give it 10 years, that'll be miniaturized. Then imagine a online database of basically, GitHub for drugs, where people are trying out and experimenting new drugs all the time that you can download yourself and print on your phone." And he says, "Now, isn't that a parenting challenge to look forward to?" So those ideas on their own, yeah, okay, not that scary. My God, my kid can do it from his device in his pocket. Okay, that's scary.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another Sunday Roast. We have two wonderful guests back with us once again. Josh, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi there, I'm Josh Russell, Josh Forward on the internet. I run the Movement Forward and Stop the Tories dot vote. We are a proportional representation campaign under the disguise of a tactical voting campaign.
Great, and we're going to get into tactical voting in a little bit. David Hennig, once again, back with us once again. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes, David Hennig, David Hennig UK on very occasional Twitter posting. I drone on boringly about trade, occasionally about UK EU matters. But I think mostly I'm quite surprised to have been invited back because in this particular roast, normally I think it's my role to insult the other guests, and that's what I intend to do again, so to make sure I'm not invited back for a few more weeks.
You have something to tell us about tractors, but we'll get to that in a moment.
We should all buy tractors. I'm going to tell you that.
I want to hear about that. Alex, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, my name is Alex, also known as Political X. I'm a historian, a journalist, and try to be an all-round nice guy. Max, my wonderful co-host, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Max. I run the Robespierre channel where I talk about British politics and Brexit in particular. Alex, what's our first topic for today?
Apparently, it's tractors and farming. David, why should we be buying like Mercedes tractors?
Look, I don't think it matters what tractors you buy, but I think you will, there have been farmers' protests across Europe because they're not being protected enough, even though they're hugely subsidized. And we've even seen a few in the UK. So buy a tractor and get your cause, get your own subsidy. But that's not really, there's a couple of stories that are really out there. One is Brexit again. It is the fact that food coming in from the EU will now, importers will have to pay charges to have the food inspected if it is products of animal origin. And that is coming in at the end of April. And that means, particularly for smaller importers, there's going to be less choice. And at the same time, you have farmers protesting about the scheme to replace common agricultural policy. It turns out it was harder than people thought to just simply replace the common agricultural policy. It turns out that we have no idea what we actually want farmers to do. It's not clear whether we want them to grow food or not. Not clear whether we want to import food or not. So it's all a complete mess going on, basically. And basically, we're just going to have to hope that the supermarkets keep feeding us, because it's not entirely clear that the government has a clue what it wants to do. And it's another Brexit slow motion car crash. Any questions?
Could these checks coming in actually help British farmers in some way? Because they would be increasing the price of imports. So would it push more farmers to produce more produce for Britain?
The nature of agricultural supply chains is such that the answer to that question is nobody knows the answer to that question, other than the people who are working in little rooms for Tesco and Sainsbury's and whatever. It is possible that we may want to produce more of our own food. We're quite good at producing arable crops in East Anglia. Livestock is generally not quite so competitive, other than the stuff that we frankly breed in places that you don't want to see, the high density farms, or whatever euphemism we wish to call for the chickens and pigs that are probably littered around the countryside. Which is obviously a little bit different to the bucolic picture of upland hill farmers of sheep, who are all, but unfortunately, who that's terribly uneconomic way of producing food. And our treasury doesn't actually want to pay for farmers. They would just like to import all the food from another country. So possible you could do that and not produce any of this. It's just all terribly confusing, really, as to what we're actually trying to do. And so in the midst of all that, it's good to have a tractor, drive it to Westminster or wherever you want to drive it to, and drive it around in circles and protest. But it's one of these cases where, can anyone tell me what UK farming policy is? No, you can't, because there is no policy. There is literally, we have no idea what the policy is. The trade deals that we had were did a trade deal with Australia. It offended farmers so much that Rishi Sunak actually ended up having to apologise to farmers and say he would never not do one like that again. It's just all a big mess. That was, I wanted to start with a subject that would cheer everybody up, and I failed. I picked a subject which is yet again another mess, something to do with Brexit, and where the governing party has no idea what it's trying to do.
Josh, does that sell you on buying a tractor?
I mean, my first question was going to be, do I have to buy a field as well? But I think there's no policy, and I think that's just typical, isn't it? Like, literally, of the Conservatives. Not only have they not done anything in their manifesto at all, and I think there was someone who's just done a really good tweet thread about that in the last few hours. But all the things they're supposed to do, they have no idea how to do, because they're constantly in campaign mode. They're not in kind of delivery mode at all, right? They don't actually care about doing real things. They just say some things that they're going to do to win some votes. And now they're realizing that they might lose votes because they haven't done it. Maybe they're having to think about it a bit more. But I think policy in this case for farming, or for most of DEFRA, I imagine, is two words: free market, right? Because that's basically what they think will fix everything. It's just that it turns out that markets don't really work like that when other markets have all sorts of rules and restrictions. So, yeah, I don't know what they're going to do. But I just saw somewhere else in a group chat I'm in about the EU, that agricultural land going for about 20 grand an acre at the moment. So I can imagine all these farms going bankrupt and then big farm buying all the land and saving the day, which happens on the high street as well, doesn't it? When all these shops close.
No, I actually that's what one thing I have written about, seriously, about the protests around Europe as well, is that I could actually see this as, small farmers actually are being badly treated. This is the rise of, huge amounts of regulation that they have to deal with, that they struggle to deal with. The law and large farming establishments can just deal with it a lot easier. They deal with the supermarkets, and you are basically, that's the direction the economy is moving to, without anybody really having the say so.
They voted for it, though, of course.
I'm not sure anybody voted for anything in the way things are.
I remember a big referendum.
The threat I think you refer to, Josh, was Alexandreou under the Best for Britain banner. The reason I know that is that he would have probably been better on this show than me, because he's also got a beard. And I'm feeling a bit left out right now on that, so I just mentioned that, you know. So he also has more records than I have for CD. So in all manner of things, I don't much like don't much like Alex. Not a man with, he's got a wall of records. It's just so impressive. Anyway, that's off topic, but we need to be off topic occasionally just to lighten the mood. You're right. It's just all a big mess, and we've just become really rubbish at doing policy in the UK.
If only someone could have warned us. Like, why weren't we told? Why weren't we told what would happen?
And I just do wonder, Josh, are all those sticky notes behind you, is that secret missing government policy?
Missing? I mean, I don't think it'd be
assume that there is no policy, so it's got to be somewhere. Maybe on your sticky notes is what the government needs to be doing next.
Well, I mean, what does government need to do next? We could do a whole show about that, I think.
We're here.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually did work in the Government Digital Service about 10 years ago, GDS, and one of the first projects at GDS was mapping out government, right? So working out what is government, what's there to do, what are all the teams and the projects and everything else, and, you know, then all the responsibilities and the chains of command and everything else, right? 18 departments at the time. I think there are still 18 departments, are there? And about 750 services that deliver something to the public, I think. That doesn't include NHS or security services, I think. So that's just main and or local government, right? So 750 services, all of which have expenditures, all of which, you know, is someone's priority. So where the hell do you start, right? And, you know, so what we were trying to work out is you start with where there's a good balance of risk and impact, basically, which is a classic thing, obviously, but like where it's low risk but high impact. So if you get it horribly wrong, the risk of something going horribly wrong is pretty low. But if you get it right, it's really, really high impact. And so that's what I would be doing. I'd be mapping out government and going, right, what can I mean, this is the classic first 100 days thing of a government, isn't it? It's like, what should I prioritize in my first 100 days to really make some impact happen? That is something I can show off about, you know, something that might help me, you know, get elected the next time. But it's also urgent too, right? And so how do you choose, how do you prioritize out of so many different things? And of course, each of those services doesn't necessarily represent a single outcome. There's, you know, you've got to think about this as a system as well. So if you wanted to solve housing, that's just not one service you go to, right? There's probably about 30 different services you go to. So yeah, how do you prioritize what to fix first? I don't know. But
I don't see any of them being short term. It's always stuff you can do short term. I don't see the problems that you need to do to solve it being short term. Everything is now a long term project. I've just done a video on mental health. What we've got coming in just on mental health alone is a massive issue. There's 1.9 million people saying they've got mental health issues. That is a huge amount of money you're going to have to flood in there. Like, I think Nadine Dorries made a comparison between that and the prison services. There are 100,000 and saying that they spend as much on mental health as they do in the prison service. There are about 90 to 100,000 people at any one time inside the prison service. There are 1.9 million people needing mental health support. And she's making the equivalency there with people who've been locked up for doing something wrong versus people who need help. And you're going, she's a nurse. I'd like to think more of a nurse ratchet than Mary C. Cole. But nonetheless, you're going, she's had training, she's had experience, she's worked in government, and she still hasn't got a clue. And you'd think that that would be the type of person I assume that's why she was made as Minister for Mental Health, because she's got some sort of medical background. You're just going, no, she's full on nurse ratchet. I'm just going to look. I would assume that would be her policy, because, I mean, we were talking about assisted death earlier. The simple solution to all the mental health problems would just be to lobotomize everyone. And you've got a load of proles as a workforce. Go on, David. I see you want to jump in. Max,
we did used to institutionalize a large number of people. That was the previous policy. But what I agree with you. It's something that I've been having an argument with quite a lot of people on Twitter. You don't say. I've been having an argument. Everything is complex now. All the policy challenges are complex. There's no such thing as coming in easy. But what I really want to say was, where does the current government go horribly wrong? Just on my own subject of trade, but I think it's the case on all of these. It actually had no strategy. It literally said, you know, we're going to Brexit and everything will be great. And actually, that dates back to, you know, to Boris Johnson. It's boosterism. It'll all be great with no strategy whatsoever. So in my own field, in trade, in UK relations, there's no strategy. We'll sign some deals and it'll all be great. Well, what deals? Doing what? I mean, how?
I'd say there was a strategy. I'd say to follow Patrick Minford.
Nah, it wasn't a strategy, though. It was just, we're going to do stuff. And actually, I'm worried about the next government, particularly on an issue, say, like housing, but I think you could do it on universities and a lot of things. Right, what is the, why have a housing policy? Is our problem that we're short of houses? It might be. Is our problem that houses are too expensive? It might be. Is the problem that we don't have enough social housing? Might be. Is our problem that we don't have housing in the wrong places? Is our problem that we need more houses in London or big cities? Is our problem that we, you can see, I'm slightly worried that the idea of build more houses is a bit like the idea of have more trade deals. You know, in theory, that sounds great. But, in practice, where? What to do to achieve what? And sorry, now Josh is wanting to come back in because you started housing.
I was just going to say, you said their plan was to do something. I don't think that's the case at all. I think their plan was things will happen, right? Things will happen for them, right? They'll just, during Brexit especially, and you can even imagine this during the last few elections as well, that it kind of didn't matter either way whether it worked out or not. They were just a dog chasing a car, So this one they caught, right? They caught this car. I haven't got a clue what to do with it at all. Boris himself had two letters written, didn't he? He wasn't sure which side he was going to go on, whether he was going to be a Remain or a Leave side. He was thinking about himself, really. He didn't have any kind of personal or even ideological investment in it, I don't think. It was just like, which way should I go to kind of push my career forward, essentially. No plan whatsoever at all, other than a script to read out, right?
I assume there was a level of... It's always, if you want to advance your political career, it's always better to make yourself look like a bit of a nationalist, which is, I assume, why he landed on that side.
So, get in the media.
Just looking at a historical perspective, not personally saying that is, but if he went on the nationalist thing and he lost, you could say, oh, look at me, I'm a great person. That gets me a little bit more of a foot in with British people in general. Go on, John.
Yeah, in a tight election, name recognition goes a long way. Right. So people don't necessarily have to know a lot about what you stand for, what you've done or who you are. But if they know you, you're more likely to get their vote in some cases. So, yeah. Sorry, Max.
No. Yeah, and that is a problem. I think that needs to be sorted out because we need to look at policies instead of personalities. But I think a major problem is also there's a lack of consensus when it comes to dealing with particular issues. For example, housing that was brought up there. There's no feeling within both parties, okay, this is what we need to do when it comes to housing. The Tories are talking the talk, but they don't actually deliver on anything. And I'm worried that Labour, when they get into power, that they're saying, what we need to do is build more houses. But as David said, where and how? And, are you going to offload this onto councils? Are councils going to be allowed to have input? How is it going to be done? Are there going to be targets? And where are you going to find materials, for example, back to Brexit, getting stuff imported, and workers when it comes to freedom of movement? So I think they're, it's a nice idea, build more houses, but where is the plan?
Pretty expensive long-term thing rather than a short-term solution as well. Sorry, David.
I'm still going to push back slightly with the Patrick Minford thing, just because it seems that he came out in committee and said, let's just get rid of as many protections as possible and run down iron and steel and just get it all imported in. And then Boris had that weird speech about talking about taking off his Superman glasses and sort of encouraging the rest of the world to do free trade when that was absolutely not going to happen because everyone was going protectionist. As soon as Trump did it with the China trade deal, that then seemed to exacerbate and push it in every direction with the rest of the world. And obviously Russia and Ukraine had to go protectionist because they're not allowed to import or export.
Yeah, but I think you're confusing two very, very simplistic views of the world to get together just because they sound the same. You're assuming that they actually are the same. You've got one economist who consistently says completely bizarre things, and one politician who consistently says very bizarre things. And the fact they just happen to sort of coincide on this issue of free trade, neither of them would know what modern free trade was if it slapped them on the face. I mean, you've got that problem with trade anyway, generally at the moment, which is that trade is happening in outside of politicians' control, which they're not very happy about. Politicians across the political spectrum. What is free trade? Well, go and ask Sainsbury's or the major container company. companies or whatever it is, or the English Premier League, various things. They're all engaged in trade. And then you've got these politicians talking about free trade, where what they mean is, you know, being able to sell UK biscuits to Australia or something like that. And it's just such a minor thing in comparison. So, you know, I don't think the Minford thing was taken as a anybody's blueprint. And free trade was just a sort of a slogan for the Brexit folk that they didn't really, that many of them didn't really understand. Plus, which the people who were voting for Brexit by and large didn't want free trade. They were actually voting to run away from globalization. It's all a complete mess, to be honest.
Can I say
this into our wider topic of the fact that nobody has a plan, and we just express things. And at some point, I'm going to, you know, get the chance to ask Josh whether he thinks that, you know, if you have a different voting system, you get away from some of this short term mess. Is part of the problem just simply that we have such a, you know, winner takes all voting system or whatever, and we have a media that demands action now, and basically, you know, do we need to, you know, root and branch change it in order to really tackle issues? I don't know, housing, trade, whatever you want to tackle. Is that, you know, are we just in a structural problem? So at some point you can answer that, Josh, or you can wait for a while, or you can just choose not to. It's not my show, but
let's let Max come back in and I'll think on it. But yeah, I'm happy to answer some of that.
Is it, if we're looking at, for example, a policy that Labour are talking about at the moment about childcare, and they said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to review it, we're going to listen to the experts, and then come back with a policy. This sounded like pretty sound thinking to me, as opposed to what Boris Johnson and the Tories were doing, is like roll out the policy and then think about how to implement it after. So are we seeing a bit of a change with maybe what the Labour Party are doing is going to the experts first, going to people like David first and saying, look, can we do this? And David says, no, you can't. And then they don't do it, as opposed to what the Tories are like, yeah, let's just send people to Rwanda, or let's have a free childcare for everyone. And then after they discover, actually, we can't do that.
I mean, I don't know the childcare example, although I suppose it is another example where the Johnson approach was to, have as many as possible. It would trade deals or children or whatever it is, rather than having a strategy. So I couldn't resist that one. Cheap shot, obviously. In some areas, I'm sure that's the case, that, you know, like Labour is thinking, I hadn't come across that in childcare. So I think there is some evidence. And I mean, I wouldn't see this as rocket science. It's what I consider to be normal government. You actually go to some sane people, you have a discussion about it, and then you do something vaguely sensible. I think the problem comes when it comes to really complex matters like, say, you know, housing. What are you actually trying to achieve? Things where you need to make a decision. Universities is a classic one at the moment. Yeah, universities. How much do you want to charge people? How many foreign students do you want? Those two are strongly related. And, do we want our universities to be the universities to the world or to the UK? If they're universities to the world, then we might be able to get away with charging people, students from the UK, less. But we'll have more students coming here, which will bump up the immigration figures. What do you actually want?
But they don't want either.
Yeah, they don't want either, exactly.
Rishi Sunak doesn't want university students, and he doesn't want foreign students coming in, even though it props it up. I think there was a stat that came out about a month ago that suggested that university fees in the UK are now the second highest in the world. You're going, what the... But, I mean, you've got the same issue with the doctors. I'll bring you in 2 seconds, Josh. Then they've just offered 205 places extra for doctors. And you're going, how's that going to solve anything when we've got a mental health crisis? I get why you're saying you don't think there was a plan. I think they had a plan and they didn't actually understand what the plan was and just went ahead and said it. I totally agree with that. I think they felt that they had some sort of plan, like Singapore on Thames, and allow all the goods in of all the world and it'll all be cheap if any of it fucks all the industry. And that's not what Brexiteers voted for or wanted. They wanted protectionism. And that's where you've got this, like, or what they understand to be protectionism. I think that's where this all comes in. And it does reflect all the other things, like childcare, no plan, old age, no plan, housing, no plan, trade, no plan. It is literally just shoot it off the cuff with the rough idea of, like, this weird neoliberal idea of just let stuff happen. It's like they're literally a bunch of hippies with economics. Like, it's really bizarre, considering they're considered, like, most of us would probably consider them to be right, far right. They're actually just a bunch of hippies who just are like, yeah, let stuff happen. Who cares? It'll all work out. Private sector fixes everything. It's just lunacy. Go on, Josh.
No, that's it. I mean, you know, I think if they've ever got a plan for anything, it's which company can we farm it out to, basically, right? And then which one have you got shares in? Oh, yeah, no, I don't have shares in that one yet. Let's go and see what else is out there. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that the plan is, of course, to have things they can say they have done rather than have actually delivered outcomes so that they can say that in propaganda, basically, right? But we're all assuming that they have what you would think would be the traditional intentions of what a party or a group of politicians have, right? And why they go into it. Why do people go into politics? Oh, they want to make the world better and all this stuff. Well, we just assume that, right? And actually, I don't think these people have those intentions at all. And it's really, really clear. Because if they did, like I said before we started, it'd be super easy for them to be winning the next election. Super easy, right? Just do some good stuff. Just do some good stuff. But they don't know what that is, how to, why they would, right? How, I mean, any of it. They just don't know how to do any of it, literally at all. So we've got to stop assuming good intentions from these people. People go into politics for other reasons, right? You know, and if there's a lot of money, I mean, think about this, right? Our country, one of the biggest spenders in the world, aren't they? You know, one of the biggest budgets in the world as well. Obviously, we're a country, right? We have a huge budget, you know, hundreds of billions of pounds to spend a year, basically on stuff that we have an incumbent user base of 70 million people need, right? We need to spend our money on stuff for our country, right? And you look at that, and you're a free market capitalist, you know, who's worked in banking and watched all the shares of all these companies that have government contracts and going, oh, I should just move up the chain a bit, be in control of that. That's literally what you think. You know, I know I'm simplifying this quite a lot, but like they are quite simple. They're chasing the money. What's the plan? Make money. That's the plan. Like, it's as simple as that. For example, giving contracts to their friends who then give some of that money back to the party, right? That's our money that they are giving to their mates that is then funding their business. That is an investment. That is ROI.
ROI stands for return on investment. It's a financial metric used to evaluate the efficiency or profitability of an investment.
Why would you get out of that, right? Now, the trick is to stay in the job, right? But they can't do the good things to be able to stay in the job. There is, of course, one theory that every 10, 15 years or so, they have to give the Labour Party a chance to rebuild everything so they can come back and sell it all off, right? the other thing that's going on right now is that everyone's trying to work out when the next election will be. We all thought it was going to be May 2nd because that was sensible, right? It was a good time to do it. There was already local elections. People already going to the polls. That little clip of that woman saying, oh, not another one, that will come up again and again and again for the next 6 months, right? Why will it be later in the year? Now, Phil and I have spoken about this a little bit, you know, and he's like, well, there's nothing left to steal, you know? I'm like, yeah, no, good point. But if you look at what they've done in the last couple of months and this new NHS contract, for example, there are still contracts that are not about the next 9 months. They're about the next 10 years, you know? So it's about putting in place revenue streams that cannot be taken down because the contracts are so long and very expensive to get out of as well, because you end up having to take companies to court, essentially, which the next government will have to deal with, right? So the next government will have a huge burden of all these contracts and will be called out by all the right-wing media for spending loads of taxpayer money trying to get out of them as well, right? So that's what they'll be doing for the next 9 months, is setting up all these other contracts that basically, you know, don't really deliver anything except profit for them for the next 10 years and a really difficult, you know, poisoned earth for the next government, essentially.
There is a principle within parliament that it's ultimately sovereign and can't be held to account of previous parliaments. So you'd probably have to pass two sets of laws, one saying that you're not held to any previous contracts set by a previous government. And then the second one would be then to then pass law to nullify it without compensation. But you'd then have a major issue with any company trusting you with that work again. So this is a terrible thing to say, but this is the advantage of leaving the EU, is parliament is completely sovereign and can pass whatever the hell it wants. As long as it's in the manifesto, it can't be challenged by... I'm looking at it from the Commons perspective. As long as it's in the manifesto, it can't be challenged by the Lords.
Okay.
So
there's conventions around that. There's not.
There are conventions around that. But there's limitations in the areas that you can look into. So I'm simplifying it. But in theory, that would be a workaround. But it would also devastate.
Traditionally, of course, you also wouldn't do these long contracts coming up to an election as well. Right. So there's all sorts of tradition and convention that's being broken right now.
Well, at risk of being the rabid right winger on the panel, I'm actually less skeptical. I think that most politicians go into it with the best intentions. I'm more on the kind of chaos and incompetence theory rather than the venal theory, mainly because there's a lot of easier ways to make money. It doesn't, a few of them may go into it for that reason, and a few more may decide to stay in it for that reason. And I'm afraid that, in my opinion, it's not just limited to one party. So I'm afraid that I don't have that view on the Conservatives are just here to sell it off. If I look at the levels of competence around the government in the last few years, I don't think they're competent enough to have such a plot. I look at the last few years, I just see chaos kind of everywhere.
Well, there's
to join up one thing and another thing and actually make serious policy.
Chaos can be a strategy, of course. Chaos can be a strategy, of course, right? And then you've also got the two categories of Tory MP, right? The ones that are chasing the 100 grand a year and the ones that are chasing the 100 million a year, right? And one group is the useful idiots, right? The Lee Andersons, they're the useful idiots, So yes, they're incompetent, but they're still there chasing the money, just not the right scale of money. Everyone else is quite competent at using them, but not competent at doing government. Do you see what I mean? Like, yes, there's competence, but not the kind of competence a country needs, right? The kind of competence a bank needs.
I guess there's like two levels to it, because I'm sort of seeing the fox and the hounds view here. I'm going, these guys are incredibly incompetent and deranged and make up stuff that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I referenced Anne Widdecombe earlier. Like, someone's interviewing her about whether or not people should be having more kids, and she's demanded that they have more kids, even though she's not got any kids. And I sort of see that level of like bumbling uselessness throughout. I mean, I wouldn't be able to put Boris into any single position in any single job without worrying that he'd absolutely destroy whatever company he worked for or council. Like, even litter picking, I could see him causing absolute chaos. And so I think there's definitely an element of it. I think there are some good Conservative MPs out there. I think Nicola Blackwood, I had pretty decent conversations with in Oxfordshire in terms of education, putting across the concerns of the league tables, which she worked with me on and trying to get rid of. I failed, but there was still an element of good. There was also the Conservative MP who appeared to be a bit of a leading light in helping the sub-postmasters sort out what was going on with the post office and seemed relatively competent. It's just that the post office had way too much power in comparison to an MP. So I'm sort of mixed on it. I think there are pockets of little bits and pieces everywhere. Some people going for the 100 million, some people going out for themselves, some people and going for the gravy train, some people going in for like the goodness of the community and actually liking it. And I think there are elements of just pure stupidity. Max, do you want to jump in?
No, but like, if you look at the people who climb the ladder, it takes a certain type of person to do that. And they're not going to be the types of people who get into politics because they want to improve things. They're the ones who get into politics because they want to better their careers. So I think if you look at the decent people who are in politics, they're generally at the bottom. They're backbenchers. They're not I always ask the question, why is Rishi Sunak a member of parliament? He's not there for the money. He has loads of money. He's not there to improve his constituency, because what has he done for his constituency? He's not like the type of MP that I imagine would have his surgery open every Saturday. You could go there and explain your problems to him. So like, what is he there for? And the conclusion I've come to is just to enrich himself and his family. Like, And that's why he, and this is why I've disagreed with people about the May election. I had said, look, I think he's going to be there. He would stay there until January next year because he wants to enrich himself as much as possible. Mm-hmm. It would be the party that would get him out before then. So I think the October election, I had always gone for the October election because I believed he, if you just look at it, if he's making the decision, then he'll stay there as long as he can. He would prefer January, but the party wouldn't tolerate that because they're going to say, yeah, okay, it's good for you, but it's not good for me because I'm going to end up losing my seat. So, or I'm going to, you know, there's a real risk that I lose my seat if I'm in a marginal. So the longer this goes on, the worse it is for me. I prefer to have a May election, but then there are a whole number of dynamics and Josh knows this better than I do, but it takes a certain type of person to become a politician, and it takes another type to get to the very top. And you have to crawl over people, you have to stamp on people, you have to be pretty ruthless. Look at Boris Johnson. You know, you have to lie through your teeth, you have to be as ruthless as possible, and you have to wear a mask all the time. And normal people are not into that. I'll just say one more thing, and then we'll bring in the other guys again. I think it was Sam Harris who was talking about Donald Trump, and he said, I would prefer to have anyone, a random person taken off the street instead of Donald Trump, because a random person would actually feel the obligation on their shoulders, and they would surround themselves with people who know what they're doing. That's why it's so dangerous to have people like Donald Trump in positions of power, because their narcissism pushes them in a particular direction. Anyway,
as you were speaking there, Max, the movie Dave came to mind, you know, where the guy who looks like the president steps in for him and actually behaves like a real human being.
But like, for example, I would love if during PMQs the leader of the opposition stood up and asked a question, and the prime minister said, that's a really interesting question, and actually answered the question, you know, and actually had a real, you know, discussion about something, a real human conversation that you would normally have. You know, your boss asks you to do something, or your colleague asks you to do something, and you would say, yeah, okay, that's an interesting theory or interesting point. That's the way politics should be. It should be about trying, you know, to achieve something together. You may disagree on how you get there, but the objective should be always the same. The destination should always be the same, but instead it's become...
I think that our system of government does not help us to do this. That we have a government, you know, we elect a parliament, we elect a government with a majority, basically can do whatever they like. I don't really have to go very much to parliament. I've been, you know, you get a lot of people saying, oh, the UK government doesn't have enough power, it doesn't have enough levers it can push and make things happen. And I actually fundamentally disagree. I actually think that they have all
not
the levers.
Many.
The problem is they discover that things are more difficult than they thought, because you've got all this power. So you get in power on day one and you're like, oh, what can I do? Well, actually, nothing very easily. Nothing that's going to make a big difference very easily, because there's nothing very easy to do. But you can get sort of power hungry. So I don't agree with you all about politicians enriching themselves or whatever. I think there's far easier ways to do it. I think that it's more of a problem for what we've got is that, you know, our system's just not working very well, and Brexit is increasingly showing that, you know, we're trying to do more within our system. The system's not, it's not up to, it's not just the current lot. One of the things I think is one of the big questions about what Labour will do in government or not is Labour going to fundamentally do anything to recognise that, you know, we're showing our politics is not working very well. You know, the worry is Labour will try to do some of this stuff, will fail, and sort of populism will grow in popularity. At the moment, populism is down in popularity in the UK because it's associated with the Conservative Party, who are obviously not very good at it at the moment. But, you know, there's a risk there for a government that tries to do the right thing and fails. Is Labour going to be able to do it? Can't solve all these problems. That's politics not going to do that. Can it, you know, tackle one, two, or three things? Can it tackle social? I mean, if you tackled social care, one government tackled social care, if that was all they did, you know, it would be a huge shame. I don't know if they could it tackle, you know, universities or the health system or transport or whatever it is. You know, my favourite one, the state of our high street is terrible, you know, and we noticed that. So, can they tackle two or three things and make a noticeable difference to them? I don't know, but that is, for me, That is the big question I'm sort of looking at for a better government. Can it prove it, essentially?
It's there's an element, I mean, weirdly enough, it reminds me a bit of DNA. When you look at DNA, you also think that it all sort of been a level. You just look at DNA like that. But actually what we found is that DNA is more like a web, and you pull one thing and then it affects something else. And that's exactly what it's like with government. So, you know, you go, okay, let's go and solve the housing. But if you focus on London, then you don't solve other things. And as you've just pointed out, you've got the issue of the town centres that are dying out. There are some very interesting solutions. Essentially, you want to, from what I've looked and read at, you want to make them almost like entertainment centres. And that's not to say roller coasters and all that. You could have like a picturesque park to draw people in, because the shops are dying out because people would rather order off Amazon. But the main point here is what you're needing to do is like multifaceted. And I don't think they've got the capacity to think like that, nor do they have... I mean, you've put it really well in the past, David. They want American taxes for Scandinavian public services, and the two don't mar together. And it was interesting as well, this month there was someone went over to Norway and interviewed people and said, "You happy with the taxes you pay?" And they're like, "Yeah, because everything works." We look over here and it's like, I can't think of many things that are operating correctly. Like, I mean, people are literally pulling their teeth out. Like, we've gone back to the Victorian period, you've got a mental health crisis, you've got diseases popping up from the Victorian period, you've got people who look like they're from the Victorian period in government. It seems like there's just too many little things that need to be sorted out to be able to get there. And I'm concerned about the Labour government, because it looks like they're going down such a track of being down the centre with the manifesto that they're not actually going to achieve much. And I don't know if they even can. I mean, you'd have to raise taxes to be able to fix these problems. And I don't think they're willing to do that, because it's been so ingrained into the public not to do that, and that taxes are bad. I don't see how it's going to actually solve a lot of the problems like social care, or like, I think there was a report today that there are like 1 million potholes. We can't even get potholes. In fact, we have to get celebrities like Rod Stewart to come out of his house and film the fucking potholes.
I actually did a trip yesterday. I went to, you know, part of the Blue Wall. One has to travel around the country a little bit. And I do like to, you know, I do like to get out and about a bit. So I was out in lovely parts of Essex. And my God, some of the potholes, I mean, some of the roads were more pothole than road. And they were main dual carriageways. And I'm like, you know, I thought it was bad, some of the bits around where I live. But I, you know, literally, there were just huge holes in the roads. And you're just like... This is kind of incredible. Anyway, what I found, and obviously you go out, you know, what you have to do as a Londoner living in London is I have to go out to the countryside and talk to the locals about what they think, so I can come back and pretend that I'm terribly wise about what the people said. But obviously I didn't do anything like that because I'm from London, so obviously the idea of striking up a conversation with a stranger is impossible. So you know, obviously what I should do is make up whatever they said, which would support what I actually think they should have said. But yeah, you know, actually didn't do anything of that. It's disgusting. Outside of London, people talk to each other in public. It's shocking.
I mean, I think, you know, you need to find things that are low cost, that don't take huge amount of time and money to make happen, right? So large infrastructure projects, you know, strike those off immediately. So renationalization of a bunch of stuff, probably, right?
That's going to cost money.
It doesn't have to.
Demand that the renationalisation happens without compensation.
You could either, you know, so that's been proposed recently, hasn't it, about waiting for them to go bankrupt, right? Even Jake Rees-Mogg said this the other day. You know, you just wait for them to go bankrupt and then seize it, right? But even if you were to pay for a lot of the companies that we would nationalise, they are cheaper to do. It's cheaper to do that than the expenditure we're giving them anyway, or that we're as citizens spending on them already anyway. And the amounts of money are tiny compared to the amount of money being lost to corruption, to Brexit, to lost trade, to all these other things anyway, right? So actually, it's not a huge amount of money. It sounds like a huge amount of money because there's a lot of zeros. But actually, when you think about it in the context of the national economy, it's really not. And if you think about then the ROI over even just the first few months of some of these things, it all comes back very quickly. The other side of that is that you start to then in-house all the capability again as well, right? Mm. So even at a local level, you could have a national road repair company, right, owned by the government, employ people around the country to go and fix all the potholes, rather than what do? Now they go and hire other big companies to go and do it at a huge cost.
No, and this is why I think the tax burden is so high, is because in the past, what you would do is the tax money would go to fund public services. And now what's happening instead is you're taking money from the taxpayer, you're handing it over to the private sector at a higher rate, and you're constantly trying to keep up with just keeping the standard, you know, the minimum standard. So yeah, if you were to bring this back in-house, there would be a cost, but you would own the asset in a sense. You would own the road, you would own the water company. Like what's happening with Thames Water, it seems the government are going to have to get involved in the administration of that now. That's going to cost a huge amount of money, and they won't actually own Thames
Water. So I will come into here, because I did work many years ago for an outsourcing, two outsourcing companies actually. And, you know, what I think that, yeah, I've said this before, outsourcing has run its path, because you've got now is that it's not really about outsourcing, it's about financial engineering. And so, you know, outsourcing has run its path because companies that take on government contracts are basically working out how they can structure the financing of it. And we need to move away from that. It's actually one of the problems with housing as well, is that housing development is done in the same way. There is too much financial engineering in this country, which is being seen as that's what the private sector does. No, it's not. You know, there are reasons to do private, you know, you can do private sector things. But unfortunately, we've got to this point where things are being done on the financial engineering. Now, that's actually quite complicated, but we should do more about it. I don't know how you do it, but, you know, we really need to, you know, put all this financial engineering to one side. My more simple idea, which I've blatantly stolen from someone else, is that if you actually want to make a difference, you know, you actually, there is some simple stuff. One, again, you know, worry about government politicians. It's all become a bit too puritanical. You know, one of the problems we have in the UK is people don't feel they can afford to go to the pub anymore, or whatever it is. And we need to find some things, you know, be able to afford to go to the pub, the football, or whatever. That sort of, so, you joke about it, or the, you know, the bowls club I passed the other day, or whatever it is. We need some more social cohesion. It's that sort of thing as well. They all probably cost some stuff, but they probably cost less than a major infrastructure project. Just use the example you rightly gave. You know, you can say, yeah, what we really need to do is build lots of new reservoirs, whatever. We clearly do need to build more reservoirs, but is there stuff you can do that just makes people feel better? Yeah, you know, I just feel life sometimes feels like just large numbers of microaggressions against the individual. Like if you ever try and contact government, you know, it's just, you know, we will make it as, you know, they might as well play a message. We will make it as hard as possible for you to contact us. We won't, in fact, answer the phone for 3 hours. Then we won't tell you, and then we'll force you to, then we'll force you to do some, you know, something else. I mean, I don't know. Ban anybody who uses a phone system that says, please tell us what you were calling about, where you have to shout at it, and then, as a result of whatever you shout at the phone, nothing actually happens, and you still go through to the same person, and you have to repeat all the same things again. I mean, it just it would make us all feel a little bit better. It's just, you know, at the moment, you want a GP appointment, or you drive a car, or you want to go to the pub. There are problems at every turn.
Then you've got that conflict.
You're going to make this difficult, aren't you? Just don't make this difficult.
I can make it really easy.
You know, we've had a heavy sort of, you know, however long we've been talking about. People are going to be on the verge of despair. They're going to be listening to you on Sunday thinking, what were they saying about assisted dying? Can I do something? Make this a good comment, Alex. That's all I'm saying. Make this positive.
You've got the conflict between capitalism and socialism, or society and capitalism. Because essentially what you're saying... Part of the reason for the automation is to reduce cost. So it's like when you go into the supermarket, it's actually nicer. So I've got a supermarket near me that's now shut down. And basically the supermarket shut down because everyone was going in there and stealing. And part of the reason for everyone going in there and stealing is because there were no checkout people. It was all automated. So there was no one there to guard any of this stuff. And you're living in an area with, you know, a lot of poverty. So people just went in. They did that because they thought, okay, that's going to save us money if we don't have to hire someone, pay for their national insurance, pay their taxes, have an accountant, because all I've got is an automated robot. The irony is, if they'd actually put people in on the checkout, they would have had a natural security system, but you also would have had an element of social cohesion. So you would have actually, like, when you go in and you actually go through the counter and there's someone there, there's an element of interaction and talking and getting to know someone, and yet that's disappeared. And that's, I totally agree with you with the entertainment side of things. I think that is where society's going. I mean, we could link this into AI and robotics, and even what I just said there with the automated checkout. There's an element of dissociation that's taking place, and actually what we need to do is revert to that, but it's not cost effective. And so you've got this horrible juxtaposition, which go on, Josh.
Well, there's enough money.
Star Trek, absolutely.
There is enough money. In fact, there's an excess of money. You can see that in the way it's being hoarded, right? So there is enough money to make this, to make all this stuff happen. You know, because one of the arguments is also about job creation, right? Well, okay, here's how the future's going to work. A few people own everything and we're subservient to them for everything we want, right? Or we all get to own everything together, right? And the same outcomes can happen, right? Automation can happen, higher quality of life, all of that stuff, except without making a few people have a profit margin, which actually becomes a huge, you know, a huge part of the cost, right? So those are the two extreme outcomes. And the way I talk about that is essentially Mad Max or Star Trek, right? That's it. But to go back to David's point about pub, you know, we don't feel we can go to the pub. Why is that at the moment, right? It's actually because of the energy crisis, isn't it, right? Which goes back to my point about nationalization. So actually, yeah, it's the same thing. You do that and you have to join the dots in people's heads as to why you're doing it, right? Rather than, you know, boring democracy stuff that, you know, no one gets excited about at all. But the Tory way of doing it is taking 2p off a pint somehow, which made no difference at all, you know, and wasn't. And the other thing about nationalization of, let's say, the energy companies is it's not just the pubs it affects, right? It's every other aspect of society as well. So, you know, there actually are some quite big things that are relatively easy, low cost, that start the economy going again.
Oh, do you know how much the French energy bills went up by over the same period as us over COVID?
Not as much. Yeah, because, of course, was it? We give a lot of our energy bill money to the French, don't we? So,
like... We're exporting. We're finally exporting energy, which is quite interesting.
No, but we're exporting 4%. Our money to their 4%. Energy companies. They're also building a new nuclear plant as well, of course, you know, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. They've got a completely different policy, but ours went up about 50%. So that's arguably a capitalist model versus a socialist model. But we're
a socialist country, though. This is the joke, right? I mean, we are.
Oh, yeah.
We just are. Like, there's no way around that.
Tests.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? That we sort of agree with. In very bizarre ways. What I'll say is, I'm down on you. I'm down on utopian visions and how we're going to change it by big policies. I actually, you know, what I'd actually like to see is, look, this is the sort of stuff we can agree that there should be a sort of, basically a better living kind of agenda. That's politics. It's politics. Yeah, it's about, yeah, sure, it's about building houses, about providing good health services, but it's also about providing providing the fundamentals that allow for a better quality of life. And I just think that gets lost in where we've been at the moment. We need things that are going to, we can spend large amounts of time, as we did, talking about all the things that are wrong when they are and how terribly complicated it is to fix them all, which they are. Therefore, you just need a bit of lightness on there as well.
David, we've joined the dots, as we discussed earlier in WhatsApp. We've joined the dots. You sell nationalisation of the energy companies on the price of a pint. That's what you do, right? It's as simple as that.
He's fixed it. I don't know whether I agree or not. It doesn't really matter by now. I mean,
until there's a better plan, that's the current plan.
And what
you were talking about earlier is that, well, I don't know what to do, and these people don't have ideas. There's one. Would agree.
That's
with
what's written
well.
On all of his post-it notes behind him. That is, I did wonder.
You jest, but yeah, there are some of those, and it's pretty. I mean, this is the thing about these, what are sold or thought about as complicated, radical, bold things. A lot of it's just common sense, right? And we actually just need to talk about it on those terms, because you know, owning our own infrastructure is common sense. It just is in so many ways.
What about if we're talking social cohesion? What about religion? Doesn't that bring social cohesion? I hear Trump's got a new, I'm going to segue in, Trump's new Bible. Because this is fascinating to me. Does anyone want to explain to our audience what Trump has done with his own Bible?
So this is from what I've understood, and I may be wrong here, but I understand that there was a Bible in the past created called the Patriot Bible. And it included a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights, and something else. The Pledge of Allegiance. And all of these were included in this Bible that was sold to the public about 20 or 30 years ago. And it seems that Trump or the original author of this Bible and Trump have got together, and now they're selling it as some sort of Trump Bible, although I don't think there's any reference to Trump in it. And it seems the money is not going to the Trump campaign for re-election or for election, but it's going directly to Donald Trump himself, because he has a few bills to pay, as far as I know. And his recent sale of, was it Truth Social?
Truth Social, yeah.
Yeah, isn't going so well. And some people have lost some money. I don't know if he's lost any money, but...
Can you call them rubes, don't you?
Yeah.
What, people that get duped into stuff? Yeah,
that's people an American bought shares in that. I mean, my God. Like,
yeah. It's like buying shares in something Boris Johnson is selling.
It's not even crypto. What are these people thinking?
Is this one of the schemes that you were talking about earlier, David, where you can get rich quicker?
I mean, yeah. crypto, yeah. Never really got into crypto. See, I've always been into things which allow you to get poor quicker, you know, putting your money into football teams, you know, lower football teams or whatever, you know. So I've never really understood this get rich quickly.
You need to speak to Grant Shapps about that. He knows something about these things.
Or Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
Lancaster Football Club, as you were saying.
Listen, by the way, it's a fantastic investment opportunity for Lancaster Football Club. If you're a millionaire or billionaire listening in, please invest your money in Lancaster. It's sort of investment where, in return, you'll get a lot of personal satisfaction. Actually, the weird thing at the moment in not necessarily Lancaster, but in lower league football, it's an awful lot of Americans suddenly taking over lower league football teams. And a lot of them, I mean, some of the, it's not clear whether they genuinely think they're going to make some money, or they're just kind of basically rich and just think that they're going to use English football teams as kind of a bit of a plaything. It's actually quite bizarre.
Status thing. I own an English football team.
I think Wrexham was kind of the first one with the actors, and it's just but is it, you know, we're just a sort of poor, you know, we're a poor country for America to use as a sort of, you know, play things, but why not? I mean, if it brings, you know, actually, it has put Wrexham on the map. I mean, Hollywood superstar. So sure, you know, like, maybe at the next Oscars ceremony, they can have a draw for, you know, which famous actor takes over which, you know, struggling, you know, football team. Hey, Gwyneth Paltrow, you've always wanted to own Leighton Orient, you know?
What else can we sell off to the Americans? You know, the NHS is up right now, isn't it? I mean, so, what about British football for British people? I mean, you know, like...
You talk about social cohesion. That in many ways was...
Yeah, but if the Americans want to give us their money in return, you know...
That's not how this works. We're now giving them our money. That's the point about owning a thing like a football club, is that we now give our money to them.
No.
Not in the case of Wrexham, I mean, to be fair.
Financially, football's just a hole. Whatever money you chuck in, you ain't getting anything back. Like, you've got to be very, very... I mean, Daniel Levy for Tottenham is probably...
What about
the closest to breaking even? Most of the clubs are trying to break even. I think Arsenal might have done it. Most of them are in the hole.
You're doing it just to have a play project. But I never understood this idea that football doesn't make money. People are actually paying you money to put a logo in front of their club. Like, can you think of any other situation where you're actually paying somebody to sell their product?
Conservatives.
Yeah, but anyway, the players get money. I mean, to be fair, look, for the country as a whole. I mean, English Premier League is one of our is a big export. Now it goes on to all the players. The players then.
Yeah.
There are some slight disadvantages here, and, you know, in risk of kind of getting into serious politics again. Premier League players get 50,000 a week, or 150,000, 3 million, whatever it is. What do they do with their money? You know what the thing wants to do with their money is? Sorry, what did you say, Josh?
Tax havens.
No, it's even worse than that. Buy English houses.
Oh, yes. Assets.
There's only so many of those you can buy. And also, if you're doing that at scale, obviously there are all sorts of tax benefits to that. And effectively, you are becoming, you know, what's that word? A landlord.
They personally are not, but they used to sing at, you know, there was a former Liverpool player, Robbie Fowler, and they used to sing at Liverpool games, "We all live in a Robbie Fowler house," because he basically spent all his money on housing. And I remember in the early days of COVID, there was this thing about how the generous offer from Wilfred Zaha, who then played Crystal Palace, that he would give up his houses or some of his houses he'd allow for nurses to live there. It's like he owns 50 houses. Like, what's he doing owning 50 houses?
So what he's saying is these people are actually just like lottery winners, right? They've got no clue what to do with their money at all. But the thing is, like, the money that goes to the football players, I don't know the economics of this, but I imagine it's not the lion's share of the revenue, is it?
Yeah, it is. The
in the Premier player. In the Premier League, a lot of it is actually. In fact, it's only the Premier League that earns that sort of money. I can assure you that it's they don't earn quite as much money. Or
what are the TV licensing deals like for the advertisers there? I mean, like
not very much once you get to the lower divisions now, to be fair. So this is a whole different conversation. We just seem to be roaming free and wild here.
Well, let's bring back to see how
he's
much
he's
going to
cut us off. Yeah, exactly. I knew this was going to happen.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
I've also got a little anecdote about Rishi Sunak as well.
A personal one.
Well, not about him personally, but about how people are being unfairly maligned at the moment.
So homeless people. Or is there another group?
I mean, fact that it's hard to know who.
Well,
so many.
Well, what seems to have happened was my football team, which as some people will know is the very mighty and very small Lancaster City Football Club, but apparently on Easter Monday, some of the crowd started comparing the referee to Rishi Sunak. And I thought, look, I want to apologise, actually. I mean, I didn't see the game, but however bad the referee was, I feel that's just so unfair.